Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David. I'm in Charlottesville still, and it's a nice sunny day here, a bit cool, but I know that people really, you know, they tune in for these weather updates from Charlottesville.
Because they can always check online or other kinds of ways.
Okay, yeah, good. Exactly.
Right. So about 2 weeks ago, the UN issued a warning that we only have about a dozen years left to save the planet, that the with global warming, increasing risks for droughts, floods, extreme heat, poverty for hundreds of millions of people around the world. This news that the world was about to end, or at least will be within a couple of decades. How would you characterize the world response to this, Frank?
Well, I don't know about the world response. I mean, certainly seeing it from here in the United States, it was very interesting because that report got a lot of attention the day it came out. But it was, of course, overtaken by – I don't even remember where we were. I don't know if that was immediately post-Kavanaugh or pre-Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh vote. But certainly all these – and the murder in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and just the general Trump mayhem, it seems to have been lost. Like many of these things, it was a bit of a 1 or 2 day story. And then again, and I'm judging – I can only judge it by where I'm sitting right now. But it seems to have been kind of lost, frankly. I think globally it probably did make a bigger impact. But of course, globally, as we've seen, they seem to be taking climate change more seriously. But, you know, this is a major UN report. It was multi it was drawn up by scientists from multiple countries, and it seemed quite compelling and frankly terrifying in its prospects.
I would agree with you, and you know, that is immensely terrifying, the consequences of global warming that they lay out in the relatively short sort of time frame we have to do anything about it. I think Trump responded by saying basically that the scientists don't know anything.
Well, he said, "I don't know who drew it," which is a very interesting choice of words.
and that he has a natural aptitude for science, which I found bizarre because that's not usually how science works. But, you know, the American government responded by not responding. The British government, I think, is so caught up with Brexit that they're also not responding. And it was really horrifying in some ways to both read the report and to recognize the relative non-response to it.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder – sorry, David. I wonder if one part of the problem is we've heard a number of – increasingly, and I think justifiably so, but increasingly, frankly, apocalyptic reports about climate change in the past, say, 10 or 20 years, that I wonder, you know, those who are disposed to find the science persuasive, and I think that's probably the two of us are in that category, will find this, you know, quite worrying. But if you're not, it's just another report to ignore, frankly.
I think that seems to be the case. So all this is set up. What we want to talk about this week is the end of the world, because there have been times in which Americans have been, really some groups of Americans have confronted the end of the world before and in some cases did things about it. So we want to talk about that.
Yes, it's the end of the world as we know it, David. So we're talking about the history of the end of the world.
We will not sing now at this point, despite the musical cue. That's not our skill set. So Frank, in terms of, you know, when do Americans start to think about the end of the world? The Puritans seem obsessed with the end of the world, weren't they?
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, they are in the 17th century, in the sense that they're very concerned about, you know, Christ's return and the fate of humanity and things like this. And they're Calvinists. They believe in predestination. And so they have a very bleak worldview. And of course, they believe that the end of the world could come at any time, or that we as individuals could, of course, die at any time and our fate will be sealed. But they seem less concerned. They don't date the end of the world in the way that we see subsequent religious groups in the United States do. And this is a common phenomenon in the as you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries, where religious figures will actually set the date of the end of the world. The Puritans don't do that, but they are concerned. Their entire kind of theology, to some extent, is premised on a certain on beliefs about the world as we know it coming to an end, to be sure. But they don't date it precisely. I mean, in the way that subsequent folks will do.
Okay. And so what did, you know, they did, however, like, I guess, you know, believe that they could, even if things were preordained, that the fate of the universe was decided by God at the beginning of time or whatever, that you could sort of see portents of what the future told.
Oh, to be sure. And indeed, they interpret events in light of that. So King Philip's War in 1676 is not, they don't interpret it as the inevitable response of indigenous peoples to European colonialism and encroaching on their lands and so on, and that so much as they say, no, God is punishing us, that is Puritan settlers, for our sinfulness. And so they do believe in a kind of interventionist Old Testament providential God who does interfere in the affairs of humanity and will ultimately end the world. But again, they don't set a date on it in the same way that subsequent people will do.
Huh. Well, it's always dangerous of setting a date. And we'll talk about some people who set dates later on, because it's always a dangerous proposition, because heretofore the world has not yet ended.
Well, indeed, and apropos of the climate change report, I mean, 2040 is their kind of cutoff. In fairness, we should probably be clearer. The climate change report doesn't say that the world will end in 2040. It says that the climate change, essentially, the rise in temperature will be such that humanity will kind of reach a turning point in or a tipping point in 2040 from which it will not be able to recover.
Yes.
So it's not the. And I know you know that, but maybe that's more puritanical in the sense of these. You know, there's a point after which change can't be affected.
Yeah.
And then we're in an almost puritanical worldview where you're stuck with predestination, which is problematic because it's an obstacle to doing anything.
I think one of the troubling things about this report and the way people have responded to it with the UN report, it seems as if nobody feels empowered to do anything about it, so nobody does anything. People feel that the steps that we are taking, whether that's recycling or walking to work or what have you. The cumulative effect of that doesn't seem like it's large enough to, make a meaningful dent in the greenhouse gases and what have you being emitted by our use and abuse of the planet. Thinking though about a century or two after the Puritans, there are people who do actually put dates to the end of the world and try to hypothesize that the world is going to end in the near future. And probably my favorite example, I'm not quite sure why I have a favorite example, but I do, are the Millerites. Are you familiar with the Millerites, Frank?
I'm familiar with them in the sense that I'm familiar with the broader cultural moment of the Second Great Awakening, but I think you have a greater knowledge of the Millerites than I do, so okay. I'm happy to hand things over to you, David. Tell us about the Millerites.
I guess the context there is important to mention. This is at the height of the Second Great Awakening, this religious revival that happens in the first half of the 19th century. And one of the features of the Second Great Awakening is there's a lot of religious, not only revival, but innovation, especially in upstate New York. And the Millerites are one of these groups that emerge out of this creative religious culture in upstate New York. So the Mormon church grows up in the upstate New York, the Oneida colony is in upstate New York, and the Millerites are followers of a preacher named William Miller, who I think is a veteran of the war of 1812, and he becomes a preacher in upstate New York and a farmer, and he has an interpretation of the Bible based on a reading of the book of Daniel. There's a passage in the book of Daniel, Daniel 8:14, for those of you who want to read along at home, that talks about unto 2,300 days then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And Miller's reading of that passage, he says, well, days in that passage can be read metaphorically as years, or be translated as years. And so that in 2,300 years from the date of Daniel, I guess, Christ's second coming will occur. And he concludes, based on some fairly complicated biblical interpretation, that the second coming is going to happen either in 1843 or 1844. And then later, as the date approaches, he actually gets more and more specific, and they have debates among the Millerites about the exact date of when the second coming is going to happen. But Miller starts to preach this in the 1830s, and as the date of the second coming arrives, he gets really a very large number of people. The size of the Millerite population, historians have had difficulty estimating. But he seems to have had a big impact across upstate New York into Vermont, and through publications actually across the entire northern tier of states, and even internationally. There's something on the order of 48 Millerite publications that are coming out regularly in the 1840s, including some in the UK, in fact. And Millerite followers prepare for this coming end of the world by trying to lead a pure and sanctified life. And so some of them give up alcohol, and there's ties with the Millerites with the temperance movement. Many Millerites end up giving away all of their property on the supposition that Jesus wants us to behave in a charitable way, and so that's how one should live. Supposedly some of them embrace, you know, wearing all white clothing to have be physically pure as well as sort of spiritually pure. And so it really becomes this mass movement of, you know, people preparing for what they believe is the end of the world. The end of the world doesn't come. That's spoiler alert. The great day that the Millerite followers had eventually concluded was going to be the end of the world was October 22nd, which is actually today.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, good timing on us. I didn't realize that until I read the date on my notes. In 1844, a date that's known as the Great Disappointment in Millerite theology.
And will be known as that to anybody who listens to our podcast. Well, recorded on this day.
That's every episode, Frank.
David, I want to unpick some of this and maybe provide a little bit of context for listeners. Sure. I think it's really interesting, and I think you're right to situate this in the Second Great Awakening. I guess there's a crucial difference between the Second Great Awakening and the First Great Awakening in the first half of the 18th century, which is in the Second Great Awakening, there's an emphasis on – I mean, they're both Protestant revival movements. But in the Second Great Awakening, there's an emphasis on individual salvation, mm-hmm. and a belief that individuals need to eliminate sin from their lives and their societies – as a kind of purification, an act of purification to prepare the way for the return of Christ. And crucially, I mean, we're saying end of the world. It's not really the end of the world, because this is the return of Jesus is supposed to bring on the millennium, which is a 1,000-year reign of Jesus, which is preparatory to the end of the world in theological terms. But it's the end of the world as people know it. Sure. And the crucial aspect of this, I think, is – or a crucial aspect is it goes hand in hand with the spread of industrialization. You talked about how print culture allows for the spread of these ideas, and that's important. So to some extent, we see the spread of these ideas in the early 19th century along with the spread of the market economy and democracy and these other larger forces at work. But do you think – Millerites and these other religious groups that emerge from the Second Great Awakening are a response to a crisis or a perceived crisis? I mean, well, what explains that moment?
I think a couple of things explain it. I mean, one of the features of upstate New York that many historians have noted is that these religious revivals, and there seems to be many of them in upstate New York during the Second Great Awakening, is coterminous with the construction of the Erie Canal, which connects these remote parts of New York with the rest of the planet in important ways. And so they become, go from being backwaters to being industrial and economic hubs. You think about the ways in which Buffalo and Albany grow and all the places in between them.
Yeah, Utica, Rochester, etc.
And I think that kind of change of being deeply disconnected to being deeply integrated is, I think, one of the things that pushed people to think in new ways religiously. I mean, how do you make sense of a world that is changing rapidly around you? I think one of the things that the Millerites were able to take advantage of, and lots of other religious groups during the Second Great Awakening are able to take advantage of, is, you know, the cost of printing goes down dramatically. The steam press makes cheap publicity easy. And I think you see this with some more contemporaneous sort of end of the world groups using the internet, that the modes of communication allowed Miller's message to go beyond his small congregation to a much larger audience, because he was able, and his followers were able, to use mass media and new tools of mass media very effectively to spread this message. You know, and one of the things about, you know, the Millerite movement and these other movements that are happening in upstate New York with regards to change and social changes, a lot of them are connected either, you know, in a formal way or in an, or more in for indirect way with the raft of reform movements that are taking place in New York and in other parts of the North during the same time period. So the ways in which you know, Millerites are connected with ideas about temperance. Some Millerites are also involved in the abolition movement. It's about making the idea that you can, in fact, make tangible differences in how the world works in preparation, and the, you know, the end of the world is a motivator for doing that. I think all plays into what the popularity of the Millerite message.
What happens to them after the October 22nd, 1844?
A number of the group, the following of Miller's followers basically splinter. There's a variety of what are called Adventist movements that emerge from the Millerites. The Seventh-day Adventists today are the most prominent spiritual descendants of the Millerites, and they have a particular theological reading about what it is that happened at the Great Disappointment. But there were other Adventist groups that had theological differences with the Seventh-day Adventists, which ended up becoming the dominant branch of that. Many of Miller's followers ended up returning to more traditional forms of Christianity. There's a decade's worth of infighting that happens in the immediate aftermath of the Great Disappointment that culminated in a number of new sort of religious practices, trying to figure out how to make sense of that and incorporate it into their theology.
So I think, we've talked about the Puritans, we've talked about the Second Great Awakening. End of the world prophecies are frequently associated with religion, but not always. And indeed, I think when we get onto the 20th century, we're going to talk about some secular variants. But these are not only Christian or come from the Christian tradition. I mean, there's a prominent movement in the 1890s among Native Americans, David, which is infused with Christianity. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and the ghost dance.
Yes. So the ghost dance religion and ritual, religion maybe not using necessarily the right term for what the ghost dance was inspired by a Native leader named Wovoka, who also sometimes went by the name of Jack Wilson. And he was inspired by seeing an eclipse in 1889 to preach this ghost dance ritual. And the premise of it is that if Native peoples participated in this ritual, this circular dance ritual, which drew upon existing Native religious practices, that would bring back the Native dead. It would bring back the buffalo. It would rid the land of white people, and they could reclaim traditional homelands for Native people. And it spreads. It starts in Nevada, where Voca was from, but then it spreads very quickly to other parts of the West and the Mountain West. So it spreads to California. It spreads to the Dakotas. It spreads to Colorado and other places, and Oklahoma as well. And it really, you know, one of the things that Wovoka emphasized was that Native peoples need to put apart traditional animosities they may have had with each other, and band together as Native peoples and participating in this ritual. And he's bringing into the ghost dance not only sort of Native tradition and the Native religious practices, but there are Christian elements to it as well. He does, in fact, talk about one of the things that will happen if this ghost dance is that Jesus will come to preach to Native peoples. In fact, the Mormon Church seemed to have been very interested in the ghost dance, in large part because of the similarities they saw between the ghost dance ritual and some of their own theological practices. And the ghost dance, for a very brief moment, seems to have flourished across the Great Plains and in the mountains, Mountain West and in California. But it very quickly gets shut down. The federal government sees the ghost dance religion as a threat, in as much as they're talking of, you know, if you have Native peoples gathering together in large groups, the talking about ridding the land of white people. Some Native peoples wear, especially the Sioux, end up wearing ghost dance shirts that they believe could repel bullets. Whether that's a literal or metaphysical bullet, I guess is up for debate. But it's one of these gatherings of ghost dancers in December of 1890 that culminated at the massacre at Wounded Knee, in which hundreds of Native people were killed by the U.S. Army. People who were families of Native peoples who were gathered together to participate in this ritual. But it's very much a ritual that does envision both an end of the world and a rebirth of a new world. I mean, many of these end of the world religious conceptions, whether it's the Millerites or the ghost dance or some of the ideas that the Puritans would have articulated, the end of the world is very much about a rebirth of the world, one that some people would benefit from and other people would not, and there would be a new kind of justice formed from it.
And yet again, the prediction is not fulfilled, and therefore ultimately phrase the great disappointment. I mean, does a great disappointment follow all of these predictions, at least until we get one that's accurate?
Well, the ghost dance happens at the point at which, to hark on to Frederick Jackson Turner, in which the frontier is closing, in which the future for Native Americans looks particularly bleak. In some ways it's a last gasp, if you will, of Native peoples trying to figure out a way spiritually to deal with the end of their world, in terms of living as free people, independent of the authority of the federal government, of white people, and so it really, in some ways, was the end of their world, but it just didn't culminate in the revival that Wovoka talked about.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because the 1890s, to some extent, and of course it coincides with the 400th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in the New World, is probably the nadir for Native peoples. I mean, in the United States, it's the culmination of the displacement of Native Americans throughout the 19th century and the implementation of the reservation policy, particularly after the Civil War. But it does not anticipate the kind of renaissance that Native peoples will have during the 20th and 21st centuries, when populations were bound and new cultural practices are emerge.
Oh, to be sure.
And I know, again, I know you know that and weren't suggesting otherwise, but it did appear to be the end of the world. Certainly.
Yeah, no, I mean, there were people who were talking in the 1880s about the possibility of Native Americans going extinct.
Right.
And I think the ghost dance is in some ways, obviously, a response to that kind of discourse. So when we get to the 20th century, though, I think we get sort of new versions of the end of the world, and a lot of these, I think, are technologically based.
And secular.
Secular.
Sometimes infused with theology, but often secular.
And so probably the most famous of these has to do with the possibility that the Cold War would culminate in atomic annihilation. Do you want to talk about how people conceived of that, Frank, and what how people actually acted upon the possibility that bombs would rain down on the United States and the world as we know it?
Sure. I mean, the Cold War does create a scenario where the end of the world is foreseeable, not at the hands of God, as it were, so much as at the instigated by human beings, either deliberately or by accident. And there's a great deal of fear about this. And to my mind, quite justifiable fear throughout the kind of period from right after the Second World War, or certainly once the Soviets developed their own nuclear capability, and to some extent down to the present, but certainly down to the end of the Cold War in 1989 or 91, depending on where you want to date it. And what's interesting, it's interesting in a number of levels. First of all, there are a number of close calls. The Cuban Missile Crisis being the most famous, but there was, I saw a story over the weekend talking about an incident, a near accidental nuclear war in 1983. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I think was that the one with the birds, where the birds let off the false alarm with the radar, or is that?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, I think that's the one. And the point being, there was a kind of shadow, mushroom cloud shaped shadow over humanity for a long part of the second half of the 20th century. And Americans responded in a number of ways. Most prominently, they built bomb shelters.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of practice in the 1950s in particular, where wealthy families would kind of build bomb shelters in their backyards and stock them with canned goods in anticipation of a possible nuclear war, and hoping, as it were, to kind of ride it out and I guess emerge unscathed for what came next. I don't know. And the fear of nuclear war permeated popular culture. I mean, you see episodes of The Twilight Zone, which are about this, either literally or figuratively. There were episodes of the original Star Trek series, which were, alluded to nuclear war. I don't know whether, David, you remember seeing The Day After, the movie on television.
Sure. Yeah.
When was that? 81, 82, something like that?
I think 81.
Right. Yeah. And that portrayed, that presented a it was terrifying, a kind of view of what would happen if there were a nuclear war and how it would affect the United States. And so this kind of infused the culture in a way that I think some of our younger listeners will find difficult to understand, because it was just in the 1980s, it was a reality. And indeed, over the weekend, Donald Trump announced that the United States is going to repudiate one of its nuclear agreements with with Russia, the former Soviet Union. And those agreements, particularly the ones concluded by none other than kind of Republican icon Ronald Reagan, were really, really important in terms of kind of relieving some of this stress and pressure. But for a long time, people just lived with the belief that the end of the world might happen.
Well, the thing about the fallout shelters, both the ones people are building in their backyards and the ones that are set up as public fallout shelters by the Office
schools,
of Civil Defense, and they're all, they're in basements, and there were these signs put up to indicate where they were. The question always, is would these have saved you were the bombs to fall? And the answer, of course, is no. That that you know these are, you know, as much about creating a kind of mental framework that allows you to go about your day-to-day life with this threat of the end of the world looming, thinking that you could do something about it when in fact you can't. You know, there was never enough, you know, if you think about the food that the shelters had and the amount of, you know, air circulation, other kinds of things, these aren't actual things that would save your life. They would merely give you the comfort that you could do something. And not only are people doing this, but the federal government is doing this, thinking about, okay, how are we going to continue the government were the world to end?
Right.
And they build an enormous, basically secret government fallout shelter in the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia that was designed to be the house where the locations of the government were the bombs to drop. And so they build this enormous underground, partially built into a mountain, secret government center. I think they built it from 59 to 62. And, you know, it's built next to this resort or adjacent to this resort. There's like a secret door that you went through to get into the secret government facility. But they were planning for how do we carry on once the civilization as we know it has ceased to exist. Again, there, you know, one looks at constructions like that and say, does, you know, is this actually a realistic way of, you know, how a government could continue at the end of the world? And of course, the answer is probably not. You know, the likelihood that Congress could relocate to West Virginia and hide out in a fallout shelter until the radiation had left is, you know, it strains credibility, at least to me.
Well, not least because what would they actually govern?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, there is a slight problem there. But, I mean, what's striking, David, as you describe this, is to me at least, is there's a real difference between religiously oriented scenarios about the end of the world and the more secular versions, in that for people who subscribe to kind of millennial approaches to the world, you know, the return of Christ for a 1,000-year reign before the end of the world, etc., there's something in it for them. Some people will see that as deliverance and you know, you might go to heaven at the end. Whereas in the secular versions, you know, living in a fallout shelter or even living in a luxury fallout shelter next to the Greenbrier Resort, eating canned food, is hardly a it isn't heaven.
No,
that's for sure.
It's a horror story in which you get to survive, right?
Yeah. And interestingly, we've seen this persisting. There was a story in the New York Times about 6 or 7 weeks ago, I think. I could be wrong about that. About kind of Silicon Valley moguls building their own underground shelters, not necessarily bomb shelters, so much as shelters to they're almost like subterranean mansion versions of a safe room.
Yes.
So, you know, in response to whatever cataclysm comes, whether it be climate change or
zombie apocalypse. Yeah.
Exactly, that they'll be able to kind of ride it out in luxury underground. But I wonder if we do survive, these won't appear not unlike those bomb shelters built in the 1950s, but just on a grander scale.
Oh, to be sure, right? I mean, the most recent example, I think, of a large group of people, though, sort of embracing this idea that the end of the world was nigh, was Y2K, which, for those of you who don't remember Y2K, this was 18 years ago, almost 19 years ago, in which many people worried that the entire computer networks that control the world would all collapse when we went from 1999 to 2000.
Because the date would be 0000.
Yeah. Oh, because the computers were built with the supposition that the date was only have two numbers. And so when you went from 99 to 0, that the computers wouldn't be able to handle that. And you would have there were people who were talking about a global banking collapse because lots of banking computers were old. And people talking about nuclear weapons, you know, going off by accident because the computers couldn't handle the wrong date. And people prepared for this by stockpiling food and water and all other kinds of things, and basically nothing happened. But I think that sort of speaks to this idea that if the end of the world comes, maybe we can do something individually to survive it, even if it's merely stockpiling some food. How does all this, do you think, inform the ways in which Americans in particular are dealing with and the sort of potential for climate change causing really meaningful, if not an end of the world in a, you know, nuclear holocaust, but an end of the world as we know it, because of rising sea levels and intense hurricanes and all other kinds of things?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, David, because on one hand, and we talked a little bit about this off air before we started recording, on one hand, one might draw the conclusion that we shouldn't panic. We've predicted the end of the world, humanity, that is, many, many times in the past. Indeed, it's we've just looked at American history here and briefly, but there are many, many examples from around the globe and throughout history of people predicting the end of the world, and most of them have been wrong. I mean, you're right that for Native peoples in the 1890s, that might not be the case. But so one conclusion we could reach is maybe we shouldn't panic about this climate change report, and 2040 will come and go and the world will still be here. And so we could draw some comfort from that. On the other hand, and let me spin that out a little bit further. You know, I don't believe either of us is a Millerite, so we can look at the Millerites and say, well, they were a bit silly, weren't they? But a climate change skeptic might look at you and I and other people who are worried about climate change and say, you know, this is our theology. We believe this is going to happen, but we are wrong. And I think that's what I don't think Donald Trump has given this much thought, but his view, he sort of said, he used the passive voice, I believe something will happen, you know, to solve this problem, or it'll change back. And again, I don't personally believe that, but we have to allow for the fact that you and I and the people who are concerned about climate change could be wrong. So that's one view. The other view is the enormity of the task before us is such that history isn't a very good guide for helping us prepare for it, both the task before us and the potential change that's coming. And we are almost paralyzed into the enormity of the task will reduce us to inactivity, and so we'll just, you know, we'll binge watch Netflix and we'll hope for the best and do our recycling and walk to work and so on and so forth, and hope for the best. And so I think that's a danger. What do you think? I mean, what lessons should we learn here, David? What should we do? It's 22 years away. It's within our lifetimes, I hope.
Yes.
Certainly within the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren. And as citizens, it's in the lifetime of people we care about and love and among whom we live.
So thing number one to do is we need to vote. I think that, you know, this is an end of the world that requires governmental action on a massive scale to make meaningful changes. One of the things about, you know, the end of the world, whether it's, you know, the Millerites or people who are, you know, thinking about Y2K, people felt like they could individually do something that would save themselves. And I think with climate change, that this requires massive governmental action on a global scale and a commitment to meaningful public policy to reduce carbon emissions and to mitigate the damage we've already done. Unfortunately, I don't see that happening yet, but, you know, one can hope for smarter politicians making good choices. Because I think this is really the crisis of our generation that we have to face. I think this is the great challenge before us is how do we deal with making this, ensure this planet is habitable for the foreseeable future. Because if this report is even, you know, half right, and I think it is, then the consequences, especially for the global poor, are actually going to be quite profound. The fate of people in Bangladesh, the fate of people in Indonesia, the fate of people who are living in poverty already and in areas that are going to be particularly damaged by global warming and sea level rise and all these kinds of things is going to have all kinds of ripple effects throughout the world that we can only dimly foresee.
I think one thing to bear in mind is we are already seeing them, whether it's the high impact hurricanes, which are stronger than ever, that have beset the United States, but also other parts of the world, or in recent years, we're seeing there's a plausible and indeed very credible interpretation that one of the explanations for the terrible war in Syria and the ensuing refugee problems has in part been caused by climate change and the fact that Syria is more arid than it used to be and hotter than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And so we are seeing this around us. It's a bit like in the image that's frequently used to discuss some of the consequences of Trumpism is talking about how, you know, boiling a frog and the water getting gradually warmer. So it's not as though in 2040 there's going to be a moment. Basically, the report says by 2040, these things will have become so bad that the habitability of the Earth might be in question. But, you know, it's already underway is what we should say.
I think that's right. I mean, this is a slow rolling end of the world, as opposed to the,
October 22nd, 1844,
or the nuclear war that didn't happen. That right. In which the entire planet becomes irradiated in a matter of hours.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I think that explains this slow rolling end of the world is one of the reasons why I think people are not panicking more than they are. I mean, I think if you look at building fallout shelters, whether it's, Y2K preppers, all these kinds of people, they have a panic mentality setting in that I think is causing people to behave in particular ways. That doesn't seem to have happened at least yet with climate change. Listeners to this 30 years in the future, if there's still listeners here 30 years in the future and this is still a viable file format, hopefully we're wrong about all these things.
Let's hope we're Millerites. That's the title of the episode, David.
Let's hope we're Millerites.
Okay. But I mean, let's hope that we look back 30 years from now and they've solved this problem, and we look like Millerites who were panicking about the end of the world and predicting the end of the world, and that, let's hope we're wrong about this.
Yes, let's.
But all let's right. not just hope. Let's act.
Oh, to be sure. Let's get to last drops, because I think your last drop may connect with a way people can act.
My last drop is germane. It's a follow-up from last week's episode, but it's also a direct follow-up from what you just were saying. I'm going to vote as soon as we finish. In fact, we got to wrap this up so I can go vote. So last week I told you that I wasn't yet sure that I was on the that my registration had gone through here in Virginia, but I can confirm to people that it has. So I am holding in my hand right now my Commonwealth of Virginia voter card, which has my complete name, my address. It has my preferred language, which is English, on it. Tells me where to vote. But it crucially says this card cannot be used as identification to vote. So I have to bring it to vote, but it's not my ID. And I have to bring my passport. It's incredibly complicated, which is a point we made last week, or it can be complicated. It's not simply a matter of going up and sort of giving your name and voting. But I'm going to vote. I'm early voting in Virginia because I'm actually going to be traveling on election day on November 6th, so I can't be here. But I'm very, very excited because, as I think I said last week, I have voted via absentee ballot since 1992. So I'm going to vote in person for the first time, I worked out, since 1990. And I love voting, so I'm really, really excited about this. So I'm going to vote. If I have anything to report about it, I'll let you know next week.
All right.
What's your last drop, David?
Oh, I'm also planning on voting today, although I'm doing it absentee because I'm 2,000 miles from the nearest polling place. So my last drop, I want to endorse an article by Honor Sachs, who's a historian at the University of Colorado. I think she's doing a year at the National Humanities Center. Anyway, she wrote an article recently in the Washington Post, How Pocahontas, the Myth, and the Slur Props Up White Supremacy. And the genesis for this article, of course, is Donald Trump's usage of Pocahontas as a slur to attack Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. And in response to this, Senator Warren's decision to release DNA results that seem to indicate that she has some Native American ancestry. And what Honor Sachs does in this article really is look at the way that Pocahontas in particular, as a symbol and as a historical personage, has been used to prop up white supremacy in various ways. She looks, for instance, at the 1995 Disney film Pocahontas, which has certain kinds of racial tropes embedded within it. But even going much further back than that, looking at the ways in which, you know, Pocahontas has been used over the past few hundred years to celebrate certain versions of American and Native relations, and to the ignorance of other kinds of history. So it's a very interesting piece trying to historicize that particular usage and what it. The way it could, what it means about this present moment, that's how Trump is using that word to attack Senator Warren. Have you had a chance to read the piece, Frank?
I did, and I thought it was excellent. Honor's a wonderful historian, and I thought it was a really powerful piece, and it provided some broader context for it. Listeners might want to know, we thought about talking about Elizabeth Warren's DNA test and the use of DNA in American history. We might return to that in a future episode, I suspect.
Yeah, I think that's on our to-do list.
Yeah.
Right. Till next time, Frank.
Excellent. Cheers, David.
Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.